Welcome, everybody, and thank you to Dana for referring Nancy to us. Nancy is a professor at the University of Kansas and a visiting researcher this summer at Microsoft Research.
Well, thank you all so much for coming. So I want to talk about some work that I've been doing for the last few years and that I'm continuing to pursue. So, broken mic? All right, so the basic idea is that economic exchange, you've got specific obligations. You have to pay your rent by this date or you get kicked out. You have a set rate of exchange, price tags on CDs. You have a time frame for repayment. If you haven't paid by that point, you're late and you can be evicted or accused of theft. You've got the law for recourse if people don't meet their obligations. The interaction is impersonal in the sense that it really doesn't matter who is interacting with whom. And the value of what is exchanged has nothing to do with who gave it to you. If you buy a shirt from one shop, it's just as valuable to you as if you've bought it from another. And you can think about, even in your shopping habits, this doesn't entirely hold. There's going to be some shops you prefer because they're really nice to you. So the lines get fuzzy right away. Social exchange, on the other hand, which looks remarkably like the literature on gift economies, if you've read any of that literature, and yet somehow these two discourses have arisen independently, with social exchange being talked about by psychologists, especially organizational psychologists, and gift economies being talked about by anthropologists, and never the two shall meet until I get there. So in contrast to economic exchange, the idea of social exchange is that the obligations are not specified. The exchange rate is not specified. In fact, if you start to negotiate this stuff, it becomes kind of taboo and problematic for relationships, right? I'll mow your lawn if you'll cut my hair. And then all of a sudden, you're in kind of this weird, ooh, that's not right. The time frame is unspecified, so you do things for people and you figure eventually it'll come back to you. But it's not like, hey, it's been a week since I did you a favor and you haven't done a favor for me, so we're through. It's based on trust, and it's based on a sense of obligation, a factor that I think becomes really important in what I'm going to talk about. It's interpersonal, so it creates feelings of friendship, of relationship, and the value of what you gain is tied to who gave it to you. So you can think about, you know, really stupid things you would never in a million years buy in a store that mean the world to you because of who gave them to you, and that's the kind of value that we're talking about in social exchange. So Michael Roloff has this nice little set of the six rewards that we have, or resources that we have that we can exchange. And in the context of economic exchange, mostly you're exchanging goods and services for money. And in the context of social exchange, all of these things get exchanged. And love here is writ large. It's not just romantic affection. It's also a sense of belonging to others, feeling like people care about you. It's meant to be a very broad category. There's norms about which things can be exchanged for which things. So the exchange of love for money is taboo, but money for services is okay. In some relationships, not in others, right? So we needed somebody to look after our house this summer. You can't ask your friend and neighbor, how much do I have to pay you to look after my house? But what we negotiated was we would provide the liquor for the party they were going to throw for the graduate students when we got back in exchange for them looking after our house, which is a great example of goods for services. And one of the ideas of gift exchange is that there always is an obligation to repay, if not directly to the person who paid, then to somebody else, the pay it forward concept, so that gifts continue to circulate and recirculate. So if you think about this in terms of the music industry, with economic exchange, this is the orientation of the mainstream music industry, right? We're selling you CDs and concerts, and you're giving us money. In terms of audiences, it's always been about gift exchange amongst audience members. I'll make you a mixtape to show how much I love you, right? Here's how economic exchange is working out for that mainstream music industry these days. Not so well. Although what I really like about the lower chart from the Recording Industry Association of America is that it starts, and you can see this in comparison to the chart above, it starts in 1999, which was the peak. So it looks like this incredible dramatic fall, and it sort of ignores the fact that what really they're back to where they were before they made us all buy CDs to replace the vinyl we had all purchased originally. 25% layoffs, 25% cuts in the rosters of the major labels. So obviously, the recording industry is in crisis, and they're blaming this, not too surprisingly, on piracy, which I will talk about a bit. So file exchange was going on before we talked about it as files. I am still a huge REM fan. I guess I'm a little REM fan. I used to be a huge REM fan. Sorry if you're watching, guys. And exchanging bootleg tapes was a really interesting example of the kind of gift exchange that went on, because you really had to know the right people. Right now you just go on Dime a Dozen and boom, they're all right there for you. But you really had to work your way into the social network. So this is an example of the cassette tape sleeves that a fan made for one that he was distributing. You really had to be in the right network. So there was a lot of status involved in having access to this at the time. It was a gift. You weren't allowed to pay money for it. And often fan communities have real taboos against the exchange of bootlegs for money. There was information here, so that I know that you can't see it, but the one on the right that's got the full band is side projects and songs by their side project. So there's information about what all the side projects are. The one on the other side has early live recordings. So there's information. There's goods. There's a service of dubbing these tapes for people. So all of those kinds of things, except for money, were being exchanged. So what happens really in the last decade, in the 90s, you had audiences communicating online. So we were beginning to start trading tapes there. And of course, like I say, there were huge historical precedents for this, like the Deadheads, who had totally worked out tape trees as a system of getting these things around and crashing on each other's couches around the country. So that none of this was invented by the internet. But what happened with the internet is that suddenly audiences went from being these constrained guys in their chair to being super powered, and they can do so many things they couldn't do before. And I'll talk in a minute about what some of those are. I think what's gotten most of the attention from the point of view of the music industry has been torrenting, and Pirate Bay in particular, but not just. We were just talking about LimeWire as another example of where some of these challenges lie. So what's happened as a consequence is this really radical decentralization. The music industry is, like all entertainment industries at this point, is built on a really centralized model where you have a very small number of companies who are controlling the overwhelming majority of production and distribution of creative materials. Publishing is another example. If you think about how the publishing houses are constantly being bought by each other until finally we're going to be just left with one publisher, and it's probably going to belong to Amazon. So you have a decentralizing of distribution that's happening, where now people can get things from each other instead of having to go to the mainstream distributors. You have artists able to distribute their materials themselves. You have decentralizing of evaluation. So instead of the press being the only ones who get to tell you what's good and what's bad, everybody and their sibling has a blog, and they can do that there. You have decentralizing of publicity, which I'll talk about. So instead of just publicists doing that, you have fans putting themselves in that position. You have curation, where you have audience members and artists themselves creating lists for other people to enjoy. And you've got decentralizing of creative production in the sense that people can make their own music or write their own books and put them out themselves now. So with that as a backdrop, I want to shift and talk about a group of Swedes who I've been looking at. And I'll play you a little Swedish pop soon, because everybody always complains that I don't. So the Swedish model, which it's sort of a reference to an educational system that they created in Sweden some time ago. And Sweden is a very interesting case, because my guess is that the number of musicians per capita in Sweden is probably higher than any place else in the world. And the country is very overrepresented in terms of international audiences and record sales. It's sort of right up there behind the United States and the United Kingdom, even though there's only 8 million Swedes, but since 7 million of them are in bands, it works out okay. The other thing is that a lot of, just as an aside, a lot of things that we think of as being American pop hits are actually Swedish products. So, for example, many of Britney Spears' singles, many of Beyoncé's singles. There's a producer in Sweden named Max Martin who writes all of that stuff. And so then the American flies into Sweden for a weekend and lays down the vocal tracks, and all the rest of it is Swedish, but nobody knows that. So Sweden's got it. It's not just ABBA. There's been a very strong Swedish influence throughout popular music for quite some time. So what you're seeing here is a couple of people who are in who run labels. So this is Martin Tornqvist. This is Kala. He runs a label called Songs I Wish I Had Written. He's part of a label called Hebrus, which I'll talk about. The Swedish model is a consortium of eight independent labels who are working together, and their basic premise is this whole debate about file sharing is stupid, it's over, it's holding us back, we need to move on. And what I really love the most about all of this, does anybody recognize who this guy is? Peter Sunde, one of the four founders of Pirate Bay. They share an office. There's their names on the doorbell together. They're really good friends. Martin seeds his entire label's catalog on Pirate Bay to make sure that the streams are high quality. He doesn't want you getting any low bitrate stuff. So that, you know, money is where their mouth is on this one. They don't just say file sharing is okay, torrenting is okay. They're hanging out with Peter. Good job recognizing him. People hardly ever do. Okay. So my approach to this, I spent a lot of time hanging out online exploring Swedish pop. It's really hard work, but somebody has to do it. For some time, I was writing reviews of Swedish records on one of the sites that I'll talk about briefly. I've spoken at some music industry events, including one in Sweden, I mean in Norway, excuse me. I've interviewed some of the fans who are really active in promoting this stuff on the web. I've talked to people running labels, talked to musicians using any way I can. What I'm doing right now is interviewing other musicians. If any of you have any friends who are rock stars, please come talk to me afterwards because I'm desperately seeking rock stars. You too on the internet, email me. All right. So how has the internet empowered fans? One thing it's done is to transcend distance and allow them to have tremendous reach. So what you're seeing here is a site called It's a Trap. It'satrap.com if you go there, which is a daily news site, Monday through Friday for, I think, 7 years now. He's posted little bits of news about Scandinavian music. And what's interesting about this is that he's located in Olympia, Washington, which I think is just about as far from Scandinavia as you can get on the globe. And yet, he's become the go-to source for Swedish, for Scandinavian music industry news. And the fact that he's in Washington and had not ever actually been to Sweden until quite recently was pretty irrelevant. Yeah?
He's a source for information in English?
In English.
Okay, so there's... Commentsphere is commentary in Swedish and in Norwegian.
There is, but... I have access to his site analytics, and at least half the visits come from Scandinavia, so you actually have Scandinavians are going there. And he gets mail from people in bands saying they learned about what they're doing on his site. So he really is, even amongst the Scandinavian industry, I mean, certainly there's people who aren't going there, but even within Scandinavia, it's become a go-to site. The internet, of course, as you all know, has provided these group infrastructures, and I've got a paper that's referenced up there in First Monday about the fact that these group infrastructures have gotten messier and messier and messier. So what you have on the screen now is the Last.fm search for groups that have to do with Sweden and groups for Swedish. And you can see you have Goo Gobs in both places, plus you've got It's a Trap, plus you've got groups on Facebook and every other network under there. So it's a real it's a real challenge, I think, for fans and for audiences and for artists to be able to reach these people, because it used to be, you know, you just went to the website or the Usenet group and there it was, and now you have this huge mess of a zillion loosely connected sites. So it creates a real problem for everybody, I think. At the same time, it empowers collective activity. You have archiving that happens online. And again, I assume that you guys are familiar with all this, but the Swedish indie pop you probably haven't looked at. So this is a website that a fan put together called Hello Surprise. And it's an archive of independent bands and labels on the internet. And what you have here is each one of these is a band, over 400 bands, and each one of these is a label. And if you click on any one of these bands, you get this screen, which will take you to a really brief bio and any of the MP3s that they have made available on the internet. So if you want to check out Swedish music, go to Hello Surprise. It's all there. You're set. I interviewed the guy who does this site, and I mean, you can just think about how much time it takes to do something like this. And I said, you know, do you ever feel like maybe you ought to get paid? He was mortified, mortified at the thought. I'm just an enthusiast. I wouldn't say I'm involved in the scene at all. The ones who are doing the work are the artists. They should have the money. So obviously, there's a lot of really interesting issues that arise around labor and what forms of reimbursement. And this also speaks to the value of social exchange, right? To monetize this, to pay him would take away from the value of what he's doing. He doesn't want money. It would be insulting to him to receive money. That's not a universal sentiment, right? So other people that I've spoken to who do a lot of this work view it as a means to get into the industry. So they view it as a step toward a professional career. And other people view it as well, I'm just being a member of the community and I'm helping out my friends here. So there's a lot of different stances they take, and the article that I've referenced there talks about those problems. You have a lot of new forms of engagement, things you could do that we just didn't used to be able to do back in the glory days of the 80s or 70s or 60s or pick a decade, any decade. So here you have being able to embed personalized radio stations. I'm not sure Last.fm lets you do this anymore because UIP people can talk about that. Being able to import who have you been listening to this week into whatever site you like. The Beatles thing there is an example of a website, lyricinterpretations.com, where people pool their interpretations of different songs. So you have all these kinds of collective intelligence that are happening. You have the MP3 blogs. These two blogs are both focus on Swedish music, and they've both been going for many years. Swedes Please is based in Chicago, focuses only on Swedish music, posting MP3s, also embedding videos more now that that's opened up. Absolute Noise is based in Paris, and he writes both in French and in English, again, only about Swedish music. Absolute Noise is a professional journalist, and he says, oh, you know what I'm doing here? It's just a hobby. I'm not even a good writer. It really doesn't deserve any money. So again, you have this sort of, I'll put myself down, and that's how I justify the labor I expend. You have people authoring wiki entries about bands, exchanging information for one another, of course. You also have people setting up clubs in different cities that focus on Swedish music around the world. So physical place continues to matter. Fika Sound, the women who run that are an interesting example also. They are in Spain, and they book Swedish acts to tour Sweden. And they organized the first concert at the Swedish embassy in Spain. And again, you get that same rhetoric from them of, oh, we're not doing anything. We're not important. We're just fans. Whereas the Tack 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 guys in London, who have since stopped doing it, They got a little bit bitter about some things because they had actually succeeded in breaking a band, and then they realized they got none of the credit and none of the benefit for having done the work that it took to break them. That's an interesting story. I can go into that later if you want. Deep breath. So as I was saying, the real challenge is to get attention. You know, on the one hand, oh, this is great. You can get your stuff out on the internet. On the other hand, how do you get anybody to pay attention? There's never been more music available. There have never been more places to find music. And the labels that I've spoken with, they say, you know, we're not even focused on selling music anymore. We just want people to hear it. We just want to get attention. This quote from Matthias from Hebrus, we've stopped thinking about ourselves as labels. We're more like music companies. We make music. We don't think about selling music. We just want to have attention, I think is typical of the sentiment. And then finally, the internet has really reduced the social distance between audience and artist. This is the website of the Cardigans, whom some of you, they had a real big hit a few years ago that I still hear when I'm shopping in department stores. It's pretty good, actually. If you're going to listen to music in department stores, you could do worse than the Cardigans. And actually, the bass player's sister is an internet researcher, so fun fact for internet scholars. Malin Svenningsen, if any of you know her. So her brother, Magnus Svenningsen, is the bass player of the Cardigans, and he runs this part of the site where you can just ask a question and they'll answer it. And this is just one example of how easy it suddenly is for people to access artists, and on the other side of that, for artists to access their audiences. So one of the things that I've been talking to artists about as I'm interviewing them right now is sort of what do they get out of this dialogue that they didn't used to get. And they hear a lot of kinds of stories they didn't used to hear. They get a lot of ongoing affirmation. So you have the exchange of information where artists are able to provide the information you want when you want it as an audience member, but you also have some interesting things happening with status, where to have the artist reply directly to you is to bestow status upon you. You're worthy of their attention. And if any of you have ever had the experience of sending an email to somebody you admire and receiving a response, it's thrilling. It really is. You know, I embarrassing story to tell on the internet, but I will anyway. My very favorite singer is a Norwegian, and his CD was not out in the United States, and I had sent him a friend request on Facebook, which I really went back and forth about, but I kind of, you know, covered my eyes and pressed send and dealt with it, and he accepted it. Of course, I later came to found he accepts everybody's friends request, but that's okay. So I was going to a conference, and I knew some people from Norway would be there, so I posted a status update and said, hey, if any of you Norwegians could bring his album, I'll pay you back because I can't get it here. Of course, I'd bought the download, but I wanted the object. And he sent me a note through Facebook and said, what's your address? I'll send it to you. And a week later, I had the CD in my mailbox autographed to Nancy, hugs and kisses. It was like the best fangirl moment I've had in years, years. And I mean, talk about reducing social distance. You know, there he is in my mailbox sending me hugs and kisses. Who could want more? This is my favorite Swedish band, the Fine Arts Showcase. And he's really fun to talk to. He's a little bit of a nut, but he's really fun to talk to. And I love what he says, you know, it's breaking down the barriers of the inaccessibility of the artist, which is good. It makes people realize it's something they can do themselves. It's important to remember that people who play music are just people. It's not this huge iconic book of rock stars. I think the rock star thing is boring and played out. It's just people playing folk music, music by the people, for the people. So again, you can see this re-leveling of status, where you have these musicians who are actively trying to level the field and say, there's nothing special about me, you can do it too, and it's important that you know that, as opposed to, say, the Mick Jaggers of the world, where you could never be me, I'm Mick Jagger. Which, you know, let's face it, there is only one Mick Jagger. This is not to say there isn't still a place for those megastars. I think there is, and I think that all of these people would agree that, but this kind of really being able to communicate directly and level the status playing field much more is it's not brand new, but it's happening on a scale that it didn't happen before. Here's the part where we get to music. So these bands, the Swedes, like I said, Tornqvist is putting all of his stuff on Pirate Bay for everybody. Hybris talks about, from the very beginning, giving away MP3s. One of the most successful of the Swedish labels is Labrador. And Labrador really try very hard to make sure that everybody can find their music. If you hear about a Labrador band, you ought to be able to get right to it. So if you go to their website, which is labrador.se, this is on the sounds part, and you can see they say they can all be streamed on Last.fm, which may not be true anymore, but it's almost all on Spotify. And you probably can't read this link, but it says, download all free Labrador MP3s as one single zip file. Right, so they're making it as easy as can be for you to get all their songs. Not all their songs, but all the singles, every single they give away. And they've got some bands that do reasonably well. Club 8 do very well, especially in Brazil and Indonesia, where nobody buys their CDs, but they're pretty much making a living touring there. Because of piracy means they've got this whole new revenue stream from international audiences that they didn't have before. Another one that is doing pretty well right now, the Marionettes have had a fair amount of American success. They've toured here many times. The one that's doing the best right now is the Radio Department, who they've been in the top 10 on e-music downloads for months now with their new record. I thought I'd just play a little bit of it, both because it's apt, but also because it's really typical of some of the sound you hear.
People see rock and roll as youth culture, and when youth culture becomes monopolized by big business, what are the youth to do? Do you have any idea? I think we should destroy the bogus capitalist process that is destroying youth culture.
So then it goes on. That kind of dreamy, ethereal, relaxing, yet bitter sound is what I love about Swedish pop. Is it always sounds so soothing and so calming, and they're always singing about being isolated and hating people, and it's such a wonderful juxtaposition. So I encourage you to go to Labrador's site and check out more of their music. So while a lot of people are responding to MP3's blogs by sending takedown notices and being very antagonistic, these guys view it as a great thing. They're not necessarily specifically targeting MP3 blogs. They tend actually to still try to target the mainstream press most directly. They try to get on the radio. They try to, which actually there was a study just released today that's written up on Read Write Web, showing that the radio is still overwhelmingly the way that people find out about new music. But again, you have this sort of exchange going on where you've got Matthias saying, if a big MP3 blog puts up a track by one of our artists, it gives us credibility. So again, you've got that social exchange, right? We give you the song, you give us credibility and help us get attention and listeners. And what's absent from this dialogue is money, right? Money doesn't show up in this discussion. And I can talk about that in a minute, where money does fit in. But they're not saying, you know, this is a threat to our income. They're not even talking about income. In fact, this is the guy who said, we don't even think about selling records. We just try to get attention. Again, there's historical precedents. I was so thrilled when I ran across this. This is an ad in the New Music Express from 1977. It's a Berlin band called Lustfaust, which you German speakers can appreciate, in the middle. And it says, send a blank tape and postage, and we'll give you the album free. All right, so again, there's historical precedence for this, but if you think about the band dubbing copies of their tapes versus seeding it on Pirate Bay, one is obviously so much easier to do. Lustfaust also did some really interesting things, like they had people design their own covers for the cassettes and then send them in, and they've been broken up for eons, but they're now trying to collect all of these things on the internet. you also have a lot of affection being exchanged. And so you have one of the big things that the people who are really active in promoting the music talk about is the ability to have relationships with the artists. But this goes both ways. So the artists talk about the value of making friends through the internet and finding friends on MySpace and then going to their town and meeting them and forming real friendships. The discourse on MySpace has really soured. But now they're all into Facebook, so there's always something. Next year it'll be something else. Amanda Palmer has, of course, been one of the most outspoken and most active and in many ways most successful people at working out how to make fans feel involved and be involved in social exchange with her. So she talks about, this was written in an open letter to her record company about why she didn't need them anymore. And in case you can't read it, it says, I brought a troupe of backup actors and dancers on the tour. We were only playing 300 to 1,000 seaters and had no money to pay them. So we passed the hat into the crowd every night. Each performer walked away from each show with about $200 in cash. The fans took care of them. They brought us dinner every night, gave us places to sleep, provision of services. I couldn't afford to put that many people up in hotels. All sans label, all using email and Twitter. The fans followed the adventure. They loved helping. So you really get at that sense of obligation here, right? She's relying on trust in her audience and trust that her audience will recognize that she gives to them, right? By putting on a great show with all of these people, by communicating with them through email, by being there for them through Twitter, and that they will then feel obliged to reciprocate, and they do. I've talked to some musicians who have given up on pricing things at their merchandise table and made them pay what you want, and are finding that they actually make much more money selling merchandise at their shows if they don't price anything and do it as a pay what you want. Yeah, who knew? So, little tip there. So one of the big issues in all of this, and I'm about done with my slides here, is what kind of new profit structures will emerge. And so you have a lot of different sites that are trying to make music available in a name-your-own-price model. Amy Street is an interesting one. We were just talking about this, apparently started by Brown alum while still enrolled at Brown. I just learned 10 minutes ago. This is an interesting one because the price changes depending on how many people have purchased it. So as things become more popular, they become more expensive. And then you had Radiohead doing the name your own price model. I haven't had the chance to really go through it and look at it. But one of the things, there was a survey that was done immediately after by, it was a music consulting group in London. Did a survey of people asking them why they paid the price or zero that they had paid. And a huge amount of stuff about morality comes out in it. You know, it's nobody really talks about, that's what I would have paid in the store, that's the price. They talk about, I owed it to them because their music has meant so much for me. So again, that sense of obligation to the band really came through. And of course, one of the things that was really interesting about Radiohead giving the music away, because you could put in zero here and they would still, you could still download it, is that when they did release the CD in CD form, it still sold incredibly well. It still went to the top of the charts. So they didn't lessen their audience by distributing it themselves for free. And some people paid a lot for it. There have been examples like Trent Reznor has really been at the forefront of this with his Nine Inch Nails stuff, where he, again, Ghosts 4 was another example of an album that he gave away for free. You could download it without paying anything, and it also was topped the charts when it was released officially. He did these different tiers where you could download it for free, you could buy the physical version, and there was also a limited edition version that cost, I think it was $250, and it was only 1,000 of them, and it had a silk screened cover he'd done himself, and it was in a nice wooden box. And there was, like I said, there was 1,000 copies made, $250 a piece. It sold out in 48 hours. So, you know, you can do the math on that one. He's not hurting. There have been some other really fun things, like Jill Sobule doing fan funding of her record, she set up a system where you could make pledges. It was modeled on sort of an NPR pledge idea in order to finance the record up front. So you could donate, there was sort of the unpolished gem level, the polished with potential, the faceted, and then it got up to the nuclear grade plutonium level, which was $10,000. And if you pledged $10,000, she would fly you to New York, put you up in a hotel, give you a singing lesson, and let you sing backing vocals on one song. And somebody did it. She wanted to raise $70,000. She raised $90,000 in 6 weeks. So there's a lot of efforts. I was to rethink how do you reshape the exchange so that it's more direct. I was speaking with a musician last week who was saying, you know, she really hopes that the profit structure that's in place now dies and that it's replaced by something that's much more direct. And her reasoning, and I think she's right on with this, is that people recognize that the artist is getting a very small cut. Now, they don't recognize the value of the work that all these other people along the way do, but they want to give to the artist. And again, this goes back to social exchange, right? The artist has done so much for me. I remember when I found my favorite band, the guy who sent me the CD. And I was so frustrated that there was a maximum amount I could pay because I thought, you know, I have disposable income. I'd pay $1,000 for each of those CDs. They mean that much to me, no problem. But there was no way for me to do that. Peter Sunda from the Pirate Bay has a new company called Flatter, which is sort of a tip jar model. And what he's trying to do is to, the idea of Flatter, it's a pun on flattery, but also flat rate. And the idea is that you pay a regular fee, like say you want to give $10 is all you have to give, or maybe you're rich and you want to give $10,000. And then people put little Flatter buttons on their websites. And if you like it, you tip the Flatter button. And at the end of the month, they divide up what you've paid equally amongst all those sites. So even the Pirate Bay guys are interested in reshaping profit structures. It's not all about theft. No musician I talk to anymore views piracy as theft. They use the term piracy, but to a person they say, that dialogue is over. It's normal now. It's not worth getting angry about. It's not worth caring about. The question is, how do you use it? The labels are way not there yet, but the musicians, for the most part, are. Of course, a lot of piracy is leaked from within to start with, as it always has been. There's also this larger issue that the labels and the musicians talk about, which is that they view it not just as a matter of me getting just reward for my effort. They view it as a matter of changing culture. So when I talk to these Swedish musicians in particular and the Swedish labels, I hear a very utopian discourse about you heard that little clip, right? Destroy the capitalist whatever that's destroying youth culture. And there is this really sort of utopian hope that somehow the internet will allow us to gather like-minded people and to reshape the way culture works in ways that benefit everybody so that it won't just be that they'll make more money, it will be that there will be larger audiences, more people will listen to good music, there'll be more out there for everybody. I love this quote. This is Johan, you can hardly see him up there. Johan in the Shadows, who is in Club 8 and in The Legends and in the Acid House Kings and runs Labrador Records. I love, this was an interview that I did on Skype chat, and you can see he puts fans in quotation marks, right, which again speaks to that status. And actually two of the musicians that I interviewed put fans in quotation marks and sort of struggled with even using that term to talk about their audience. I asked him afterwards why he was having a hard time with fans, and he said, because I think of people screaming at a Madonna concert. I don't think of people with their home stereo loving the Marionettes album. So you have this sort of utopian hope of really reshaping culture, which I think also motivates these musicians. So again, that gets back to issues of gift economies and social exchange and social culture and away from economic models. So as I finish up and as I'm thinking about where to go next, these are the kinds of questions that I'm wrestling with, and that I think all of these people involved in this are wrestling with, and I would be really thrilled to hear your thoughts on these or related questions. So clearly we've got different kinds of value operating here. Money is one value, but it's certainly not the only value. So when I talk to musicians, I hear a lot about how much it means to them when somebody tells them what a song meant to them. So I interviewed somebody last week, and I said, can you tell me about a time when an interaction you had with a fan that really was rewarding for you? And he said, I got an email from somebody I had never heard of before. It was very short. Its entire content was, my father just died, and I can't stop listening to you. Right, so that's, you can't put a price on that, right? And that, and yet it makes his experience worth it. He is currently, he's British, he's currently in the United States with his American wife and their kid, hanging out with the mother-in-law. They're paying for the entire trip by doing house concerts around the country, organized through his website. And they also recorded, in sort of the first week of the tour, they recorded one of those concerts and made it available. And it's sold enough online already, a week after its production, to cover the tour. Questions of who provides value and how people provide those different values. Lots of issues around fairness. I think the lines of exploitation versus donation are really, really fuzzy, especially when you've got fans doing so much publicity labor. And issues of people who's in careers that are no longer existing or are existing in different ways. Do you need professional videographers when fans are making videos all the time? So, for example, Coldplay has a fan video competition. They get great videos. If you're one of those people who made a living making videos for MTV in the 1980s, you're in a different line of work now because those people are no longer employable. So lots of issues with that. I think there's a lot of issues around boundaries that come from the breaking down of boundaries between artist and audience, because there's an expectation of, you jerk, I wrote to you and you didn't write back, right? I had this happen. Somebody whom I had been listening to for decades, I wrote him a fan letter and told him so. I thought it was a really nice fan letter, and he never wrote back, and I never liked him as much afterwards. But he's got the right, right? He's got the right to say, no, I don't want to have to deal with that. I never would have expected him to answer a paper letter, right? So I think that these questions of what are your boundaries, what's fair. I talked to somebody who said that she got an email one day and it said, I saw you last night on the train platform in New York City and I wanted to tell you how much your music means to me, but you were making out, so I didn't want to disturb you. And she was pretty mortified, right? As you can imagine. It gave her the creeps and grossed her out, as I think it would all of us. So a lot of these, and it wasn't so much that she had been seen as that the person wrote and told her she'd been seen. So these boundaries. One of the things that really gets me when I listen to the discourse coming out of the industry is when they talk about this ability to connect with audiences, it's always framed as monetizing, right? How can you put a price? How much is a Facebook fan is worth $1.63, I think, is what the a study that came out last week found. Every Facebook fan is worth $1.63 in annual purchases. The industry has formulae for how much each person on an email list is worth. I think it's £2.50 in annual purchases for each person on your email list. So you hear this discourse of monetize, 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 and I worry about this in terms of, first of all, not nurturing what's beautiful in this whole process, not recognizing what's really happening, which I really believe is economic exchange is part of it, but social exchange is a huge part of it. And to the extent that your question is always, how can we convert all of these things into money, you're not recognizing the social dynamics there. You're still trying to cast it in an economic model. I think that monetizing is absolutely part of it, and I do think that the crisis of how can artists get paid, how do we invest in music production up front, is hugely important, and it's an enormous problem, and it very much concerns me if labels are not able to invest in artists so that they can produce a record in a high-quality studio. I don't want to live in a world where the only music you can have is what people make at home on their laptop. I want high quality producers to get paid. I want songwriters to get paid. I want musicians to get paid. I don't want him to make billions of dollars, but I want him to make at least as much as I do. I think that's reasonable. So money is a huge piece of it, but my argument is that money fits into this larger picture. And when people don't have to pay, you have to give them a reason to want to pay. And that is, comes from the social. That comes from invoking the sense of obligation of, I care about you and I want this and I know you care about me and I want to give back. And money is one of the few things I have that I can give back. But if I can't give money, maybe I can at least turn my friends on to you and maybe some of them will buy your CD. And ultimately, I think it comes down to, just like the guy at the clip of the radio department song said, it comes down to taking it out of a purely capitalistic market structure and recognizing, again, that artistic production is a creative process. It's a core human process. It's about humans connecting to humans. It's not about people making profits. And to the extent that we focus on that and continue to focus on it, I think not just the audience, but I think that creative producers, musicians, writers, dancers, all of us are dehumanized by that process. We might as well be, you know, grinding peanuts for peanut butter. We're not, it doesn't recognize the essential humanity in the process of the creative arts. So I will leave it there and welcome your comments and questions. Thank you. Yeah.
I thought you shortchanged Amanda Palmer's fans a little bit. By saying that they saw that they had received something and they had to give something of value. I think that becoming participatory with someone you admire is really exciting, and, you know, taking home somebody from the troupe and putting them up or bringing dinner is more about just, oh, I owe them something because they gave me music. It's like, oh, boy, now I'm a part of it. And I think that that's
yes,
something that the Internet has made possible is participatory, where you can feel like you've contributed in a way that somehow improve, you know, is part of creation.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that being having a sense of being able to contribute is and participate is a huge part. The woman who runs the Sounds of Sweden, used to, she moved to Cornell because her husband got a postdoc, but she ran the Sounds of Sweden Club in Glasgow. And her explanation for why she did it is, I can't sing, I can't play a musical instrument, and this is the way that I can participate and contribute. So I think you're absolutely right that it's not just about a tit for tat, you gave to me, I'll give you some money. It's about a broadening of the ways that audience members can participate. Yes. And I think also that that's what the labels are getting at when they talk about creating a new culture also. So I think you're absolutely right.
Well, yeah. I was thinking about, the, you know, people contribute album covers, and, you know, the one that's selected, it's so exciting, you know,
mm-hmm,
to see your piece.
And that speaks to status, right? That when you're the winner, you've been bestowed, status has been bestowed upon you, yeah. Yes?
I'm wondering if in your research you came across any findings related to scale. So what I mean is, in the Amanda Palmer type structure that you talk about, or some of these other ones, which I think are, when you think about it, this is not what Mick Jagger or Bono or John Bon Jovi or any of those people, they're in a different business.
Yes.
The music industry.
Yeah.
And think of it as one thing. I think we have to think of it as something else. There seems to be now another way, which is making a livelihood, which previously was not possible because you couldn't transcend geography and the cost of communicating was so expensive. But is there a point at which it hits sort of a peak of scalability? You know what I mean? So
mm-hmm.
You can only answer so many emails. You can only stay at so many people's houses. You can only bring food for so many people. Did you find any sort of quantitative information?
You're absolutely right, and I haven't, because to this point I've pretty much been I've just started talking to people who are operating at larger scales, and of course it's kind of hard to get to those people, you know, it's hard to get Mick Jagger to give you an interview. I'm working on it, if any of you know him. But for example, I was talking to somebody in the band Mogwai the other day, and he was saying that they can't handle it. The sheer mechanics of putting people on their email list is they can't do it. They can still write the email, but they can't handle the putting people on the list. And when you talk about the industry, it's multiple industries, right? And there's new elements of industry that didn't even used to exist before. So there's whole new kinds of intermediaries like Reverb Nation or I can't remember. I'm just blanking on the name of some of the other ones. These companies that manage your list for you.
Oh, like Topspin and Chewy.
Yeah, Topspin, exactly. Yeah. Topspin is another really interesting example of these companies that this business didn't exist 10 years ago, but now you have a lot of companies who manage your fans for you. And there used to be people who organized street teams, so there is some continuity. But absolutely there's questions of scale. And I think part of the trick is enabling people to feel like they're participating and like you're talking to them and like you know who they are without having to actually respond to every single one of them. I think in a way it's kind of like teaching, right? One of the things I found in teaching is when you teach a large lecture, if you remember 10 people's name and you use those names, the students think you know all of their names and they love you for it, right? And Roseanne Cash is a really interesting example. If any of you follow her on Twitter, which I highly recommend, she's an absolute scream on Twitter. She's very fun. She twitters all the time. She twitters trivial little things. She's incredibly human and accessible. And she doesn't follow very many people, but she'll at reply you. So you know, she's replied to me 2 or 3 times over responses to her. And then I go and I look at her page and I see that in that 3 minutes she replied to 10 people. Right, and clearly it's fun for her, and she likes it. She's only following about 200 people, even though she has thousands of followers. So I think part of the trick as people hit those larger scales is to find a way to draw boundaries that enable you to have your space and have some free time and have time to create your work, yet still make the audience feel like, okay, maybe they didn't reply to you this time, but next time they could, and you're still involved. And I think that's part of the trick for how to do it. You know, if you remember, David Bowie did that early thing where he created davidbowie.com, and you could have an email address at davidbowie.com. How cool is that? I never, ever met anybody who had one, but I'm sure they must have been out there, right? So I think it's an interesting question how these things scale and what the expectations can be. Yes?
I have a question for you, Ronan.
Okay, I'm sorry. What's your question? Okay, what's your question?
Does this, I guess, this system, or kind of giving the fans like a reason to buy or a reason to pay you, does it mainly like financially work out only for artists who tour? Like, is there any hope of survivability for artists who just want to make music and like make some money off it but don't really want to go around playing?
Yeah, it's a really good question. What is the role of touring, and do you still have to tour? I don't think that you do actually have to tour to make it work. Touring, of course, has the wonderful advantage that people connect with you. And the guy I had up there a minute ago from Labrador has said that he thinks touring is more important than ever because as music has become digital, people don't have a sense of there being a thing there. It's so ephemeral. He thinks people want to go to shows because it's embodied, and they want to connect in that way. But I don't think that you have to tour in order to be able to do it. I think ultimately what's happening is that we're moving toward there just being a huge variety of models for how to make a living making music or making art, and it's going to be a long time before we can say, this kind works for that kind of person, and this kind works for that kind of person, And we're really in a time of extraordinary experimentation where people are just trying everything they can think of to see what will work and what won't. And sometimes they get flack for it, like the band Camper Van Beethoven, who've been together for an incredibly long time. Those who remember them from the 80s might be surprised to know that they still exist, but they do. And they wanted to play South by Southwest, and so they did a thing where they said they were soliciting donations for their airfare and hotel to go to South by Southwest. And if you donated, you could pick a song that they would play and they would hold up a sign with your name on it when they did it. Their assumption was that businesses would do this. And what happened was private individuals did it. And they did succeed in getting the money, but they took a lot of flack because that seemed somehow too crass for the morality of all of this for a lot of people. So it's tricky to figure it all out. And like I say, I think it's going to be a long time before questions of who has to tour and who doesn't have to tour really shake out. Or how do you do it if you're not touring? Lisa?
I have a question about media studies, which was kind of sparked by one of your slides. I mean, what does it mean when
people who make music say that the term fan is debased and irrelevant when we as scholars are now starting to do fan studies and it's becoming a burgeoning industry, right? It sounds like from the citation from this guy that fan is a debased identity that nobody wants and that no band wants to have fans because it's a term that doesn't really relate to the current economics of music and that fans are a side effect of a particular economic industrial relation. So that that relation is bad, no one wants it, no one wants fans. They don't know what they want instead, but they don't want that. Yet at the same time, we are all struggling to talk about fans, and we, in media studies, now think fans are the shit. So what is that about? You know, now fans are the coolest thing to study. They're extremely empowered in the minds of media scholars. People like Jenkins, for example, have now said that fandom is the most kind of paradigmatic state for media consumption right now, that fans are also producers, and that fans are now extremely important, and fans used to be viewed as kind of parasitic, and now fans are generative and central. So what does that disconnect mean, right? That fandom is on the one hand totally thrown out in some ways, not something that musicians seem to care about or want, yet at the same time scholars are now obsessed with fans.
Yeah, that's a really interesting critique. I think some of it goes back to your point about scale, right? I think that, you know, when I talk to Mogwai, they have no issue with the word fans. They don't meet these people. So I think some of it has to do with being indie. I think some of it has to do with casting themselves as fans as well and recognizing everybody's a fan of something. But it's a really great question. I actually disagree with Jenkins that fandom is the paradigmatic way to consume media now. I think that it's theoretically in some ways the most interesting, but I think there's an awful lot of people who consume media who really are not invested in it in terms of their identity. I think the overwhelming majority of people just watch TV and they don't go, I am an ex-fan, right? They just go, yeah, I like that show, I catch it when it's on, or yeah, I listen to that band, or I don't know who's on the radio, but I like this song, and maybe they'll buy it. But so I think some of it is scale. I think that a lot of fan studies, almost all of fan studies, focuses on television and film. And so I think that's part of it also, that music is different. It's a different kind of fandom. It's a different kind of participation. You do have a lot of those same phenomena, but you don't have... you have tribute bands, but you don't have people who, you know, you have band fan fiction, where people write fiction about the people in the band, but you don't have fiction in the sense of, I've written a whole album of songs in the style of Franz Ferdinand, right? That kind of, I mean, that's just called derivative pop and you suck. So I think that I don't think media studies is wrong to focus on fandom. I think it's been ignored for much too long, but I do think it needs to be put in this broader context of all these other ways. Like Jonathan Gray talks about, why aren't we looking at anti-fans? There's all these people who absolutely hate stuff and who are actually strongly personally invested in, like my 9-year-old son is incredibly invested in hating Justin Bieber. Right. This is very core to his identity. And my 13-year-old son is incredibly invested in hating Twilight. So we're walking down the streets of New York City the other day, and he's going, I just cannot wait until Twilight is over. I'm so sick of Twilight. No, 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 no. And I said to him, you know, there's nothing Twilight around. The only reason Twilight is here right now is that you're talking about Twilight. Right? So there's so many dynamics at play there. Yeah.
It is quite wonderful, and... I was going to make a comment on a different thread, but just in responding to this, that, you know, your son brings up an interesting point about these images of fandom and, you know, what a fan is, or what the post fan will be, as that the fellow from Club 8 that you quoted seemed to envision. And there's a lot of demographic, you know, differences that are being elided here. So, you know, a 13-year-old girl who's a huge Paramore fan, well, I mean, is she going to be able to provide them with a place to stay for the night, or, you know, give them dinner, or, you know,
like contribute her allowance, you know, to support them. It seems to me that a certain, the kind of person who can work with these new models, you know, is of a certain age, a certain income, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing that I wanted to throw out to you was that I feel that behind some of the quotes that you've presented and also some of the points you've been making is the old idea of the sort of war between sort of commercial motivation and, you know, social motivation, or the incompatibility of these.
And which
comes up with, right, love versus money. Fred Goodman has the subtitle of one of his recent books, I think, The Mansion on the Hill, you know, was like something about head-on collision of art and money or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the whole idea of selling out, right? You know, this, you could write a multi-volume work, right, about the concept of selling out. But, you know, this has a very specific geography in the musical landscape, right? And it's very, very strong in indie rock, which may have inherited that from hardcore, which inherited from some, you know, kinds of punk. My impression is that there are very few kinds of African American music in which one finds this sense of incompatibility, and that, you know, making money and getting rich is, you know, just part of being a musician. So I'm wondering if that might have an effect on which sort of genres of music might evolve different kinds of models.
Yeah, it's a great point. And one of the things I've been trying to do in recruiting people to interview is to try to have diverse genres and not just talk about indie rock, because I think for just the reasons you've said that it's much easier to make this case about indie pop than it would be about rap, perhaps. That said, even within indie pop, I think selling out is really changing, right? So that, horrified as people were to hear Iggy Pop's Lust for Life advertising Prudential Insurance, the labels that I talk to have no issue with corporate sponsorship. They think it's great if they can get, as they put it, the fuckers with money to pay for it so the fans don't have to. I think that people are, the audiences are starting to recognize the economic issues of, wait a minute, if I'm going to be downloading my music and not paying for it, then it's okay if their tour is sponsored by Target, right? So I think the selling out is in a really interesting time right now, because I'm not sure that selling out, there's a wonderful book called, Unmarketable?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where she talks about this, how DIY culture has been so co-opted by corporate sponsorship that it is really losing its meaning. And I think that it's going to be really interesting to watch selling out and see if my children's generation even have that concept anymore. Arms everywhere. Yes?
In terms of the artist who has to pay their rent and their grocery bills, you know, and their time, so they're going to be out doing one job instead of the artist's work, so they need to bring in money.
Yeah.
For that, not to get rich. Why haven't the artists gone more for the click-through CPM, for the advertising, for an advertising model, you know, where you see ads on every CD or ads in it on every post and picture? What's happened? They've been suing and they've been fighting the big ones, but they haven't been, you know, advertising, co-opting someone.
I think part of it is that the models that have relied on advertising haven't been able to make anywhere near as much revenue to replace it. So, like Last.fm tried to do that, and they had all kinds of licensing for click and play, the song you want to hear on demand, and it was ad sponsored, and it just didn't generate the kind of money that the labels had felt that they needed. So I think the jury's out on whether advertising will work as a replacement model for purchasing. At the same time, I think that a lot of people don't know how to do that, right? If you're talking about EMI Records or Warner Brother Recordings, they've got experts who know how to negotiate those deals. But if you're talking about you know, some guy in Sweden putting out 8 bands that he really, really likes. I'm not sure that he would even know how to use an advertising model. So I think there's a lot of factors, but I haven't looked at that directly. So I can't, I'm just speculating and trying to answer. It's an interesting question. Ethan, you had your arm up for a while.
So I'm sort of curious about how this phenomenon does or doesn't cross genre, really just based on production cost.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So for me, the thing that blew my mind was, as a young music fan in 1985, finding out that pretty much the best album I'd heard in 3 years, Cowboy Junkies Trinity Session, was recorded for $250, at which point I sort of said, well, geez, the only thing actually stopping me from doing this is talent. Because it was sort of like, okay, clearly it's not the money, it's my complete and total lack of talent. And
yeah,
realizing
right,
that I had
right.
to become an ethnomusicologist rather than actually becoming a musician. You know, as you know, it's all downhill from there. On some of this is when you look at alternative forms of production, so television in particular, it's one thing to sit down with a laptop and $500 and kind of demo album. It's another thing to produce an hour of broadcast television.
It sure is.
And so if you're a fan of broadcast television, you write fanfic because it's cheap. Whereas if you're a big fan of Mission to Burma, you go buy a beat-up guitar and an amp and turn it up to 11 and record it, and something else happens. So one thing that seems to happen from that is this line from fan to participant in the music scene is pretty, pretty blurry. That
yes.
almost everyone went from fan to being professional at some point, whereas there's this incredible stratification in some of these other fields where there are some fanfic writers who go on to become real TV writers, but it's pretty darn rare. And
yeah.
so what I'm wondering about that is you're doing a great job of documenting a really interesting pattern emerging in this space in a field where there's a really, really long tail.
Yes.
There's room for a lot of Jonathan Coultons who make 80K a year, answer all their fan mail, and may be able to pull this off for 10 or 20 years. In other media, feature film production, that just doesn't seem to happen. Is
right.
this going to be limited just to this field, or do we expect at some point to see production costs change in other fields, and would we see another dynamic playing out? Does this really ultimately come down to the fact that music is one of those fields where you can actually make a splash for about $1,000?
Yes, and I mean television is yeah, clearly production costs are a huge issue that shapes this. At the same time, I'm thinking about some of the things that are rattling around in my incoherent mind as I'm trying to come up with something smart to say. Is I'm thinking Blair Witch Project.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking Paranormal Activity, which didn't do that well, but which
and mariachi.
Tried to use these kinds of
dollars.
Yeah, and I mean, on the other hand, you know, you're not going to make Avatar in your basement, right? Thank God. and I think, and when I said, you know, there's always going to be room for the huge industry. I think that, and it goes back to the earlier point about, you know, there's industry operating at multiple levels here, and I think it's true that there's always going to be room for Hollywood blockbusters, and they're never going to be made by fans, though probably they'll be made by people who grew up being fans. And I think there's always going to be room for a Britney Spears and for Justin Bieber and for these Lady Gagas and these huge, huge stars. My guess is there's going to be fewer and fewer of them. And I think production costs do go down, right? Cameras are cheaper. Digital cameras are amazing now. And you can't do extraordinary special effects, but the stuff that you can do now, you certainly couldn't do 10 years ago, and all these smarty pants in the Cambridge area, I'm sure they're inventing stuff that in 10 years are going to blow our minds with what a 5-year-old can do in his bedroom. So as far as the future goes, I don't know. I mean, I think with television, you have this huge issue of access to the airwaves, which is really different from I'm going to start a label and put out my bands, right? So, but definitely huge issues of scale in all of this. Yeah.
I was wondering, you talk about like the people you seem to have interviewed have been mostly musicians and record label owners, but have you gotten any input from people like producers and sound engineers and things on how the shift in these interactions and especially the monetizing of these interactions is affecting them and any opinions that they have on how they're going to continue doing what they need to do in order to produce the high quality music you say consumers still want.
I want to go there, and I haven't gotten there yet. My take on that is that there's a lot of career switching going on. So I used to be a manager, and now I'm a digital music consultant. So those kinds of sort of lateral movements into alternative careers that still try to mediate that relationship in different ways. But to me, it's a really interesting question. What happens to the manager? What happens to the publicist? What happens to the people whose careers are to mediate that relationship when maybe it doesn't need mediation or maybe it needs a different kind of mediation? Somebody, a musician I was talking to last week said, I think it just means that you need more of those people than you used to. Because now you need not just a publicist, you need the online publicist also, right? But I haven't spoken to many of those people yet, but I when I'm done with musicians, they're next in line, the managers are next in line. Yes?
So I hate to cut this short, but we are just about out of time. I don't know if you want to take one more question, and then...
If it's okay with you, she's had her hand up so long. Yeah. Go
Someone
for it.
Someone has a better question, they can go. Yeah, fill in the spot.
It all depends on you. You better be good.
So in America, we have and I'm sure other countries do, but America's the only one I really know about here. We have these people who are rock stars, specifically, like Mick Jagger. And, like, they're these modern incarnations. Like, there's Lady Gaga, there's Kesha, Janelle Monáe. And they're not just selling us music. They're selling, fans this image and this character. And I'm wondering, in your work that you've been in the ethnographic work you were doing in Sweden, or with the Swedish indie pop stars, was there this distinction between like rock star and musician?
The people that I talk to are fans of rock stars themselves. And so I don't think there's a sense of, oh, no, you're a manufactured product, you're not a real musician. Mm-hmm. Like Martin Tornqvist talked about how originally they were all opposed to the major labels, thought they were evil, and then they said, wait a minute, we're fans of so much of what they produce that I don't want a future that doesn't have those stars in it because I'm their fan. So the question is, how can we bring the major labels into this culture we're trying to create instead of writing them off and separating ourselves from it? I'm sure that all of them, you could find an example of somebody who they thought was a manufactured product and not a real musician. But I think that the quote from the Fine Arts Showcase about music by the people, for the people, anybody can do it, mm-hmm. sort of speaks to the idea that I think they think that everybody can make music, and some people become huge celebrities doing it and some people don't. But for example, Robin has been a really successful Swedish export. I think she's Swedish. Maybe, you know, she's okay. Sometimes I forget who's Swedish and who's Norwegian, but they're huge fans of Robin. They love Robin. A lot of those people, right? And she's a huge star. She's a good example of that kind of personality. And none of them say, "Oh, Robin, I wouldn't want to be like Robin." They're all, "Have you heard the new Robin?" So I don't really think so. I don't think there is that kind of raising your own status by distancing yourself from the rock star.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, everybody, for coming.